Shipping out. We're the last survivors of Fury 161, and this is marooned on the planet of the prison colony planet of Furiosa. What is it called?
Yeah, Furiosa.
Furia.
With
Furia.
Matt and Hillary, and we're joined by Bill, and we're talking about Alien Cubed, aka Alien 3, the David Fincher edition of the Alien franchise from 1992. Ostensibly the David Fincher. He has disowned the film, important to say. And we're going to struggle through trying to figure out what the fuck is going on in this movie.
Yes, that's right. Because it is, I think we all agree, a somewhat confusing movie in many respects. A confusing movie in many respects. I quite enjoyed watching it. Oh, and we should say that we are talking about the quote unquote assembly cut. Which I guess is not the director's cut because David Fincher refused to acknowledge that he directed the movie.
Or participate in putting the assembly cut together.
The assembly cut is like a good 30 minutes longer than the theatrical release. And I think having, I've seen the original one, the theatrical version twice, and then just the assembly cut just this once. And it is actually quite different in a number of ways, which I think is kind of interesting. But so if you're listening to this, like, and you love Alien 3, whatever the fuck this movie is called, you just might want to know that, like, we've watched the long version of it.
And it was awesome. It was the right choice. 1000% the right choice. Hi, this is Bill, back for more Alien.
There's Bill. And what are things that were included in the assembly cut that are not in the original theatrical cut? Are there like whole scenes or plot lines that are
in my limited memory of this? I think one of the biggest changes is the opening scene, where we have a long, again, sort of as we did with Aliens, a long opening scene that wasn't part of it. I think in the theatrical version, if I remember right, Charles Dance just sort of like sees a shooting star, and that's what clocks him into Ripley being over there. But we get the whole sort of longer opening where he's out meandering around, meditative shots of the landscape. And then I think also the ox was a dog in the theatrical version. So the livestock, I think, that crop up in this version is, I'm sure we'll get to that, is totally different. And the fact that we've got working animals being hosts instead of domestic animals.
Yeah. And then I think that the kind of, I think truly unnecessary feeling mechanism that happens when the guy, and sorry, maybe we can talk about this. I do not know what anyone's name is in the movie except for Ripley and Dylan, who is the what's his name?
Charles Dutton
character. Nobody else's name can I remember. But there's so the guy who is like the psychopathic killer and gets brought to the infirmary and then convinces the other guy to let him out. And then he lets the alien out. I think that there's a little bit of that in the theatrical release, but I think that that is kind of amplified here.
Okay.
To really no good ends, because it doesn't particularly make sense to focus on that character. It's just like an additional sort of weirdness in the movie. But I think that's the other distinction. But the big one, I do think, is that opening, and then more contentfully, like the idea that the alien is born out of one of these oxen that are mysteriously here on a prison planet that is also an ore refining, a smelting facility.
I think the assembly cut is a perfect word term for this movie, because it should just be called Alien Assembly Cut, because famously the production of it was extremely belabored and the script went through many different drafts and iterations and concepts. Mm. And it never synthesizes. Like, I don't think it synthesizes into a coherent whole. What you have here is a really, for considering how many pieces are in it, it's a remarkably smooth mishmash, but nevertheless, it's still a mishmash. We were just talking about Top Chef, and it feels like, to me, it's like multiple different ingredients on a plate that don't ever come together, but that you can tell that you can taste everyone separately, but they're never coherent. So like that character that you were talking about, and I'll stop talking after I say this, that psychopath character that you were talking about, whose name is Golic, but we thought his name was Garlic until I turned on the subtitles. And it's like, Garlic, why don't you want to go out with Garlic? And he's like, because he smells. I'm like, yeah, he probably smells like garlic. But Garlic is, that character represents kind of like a serial killer, like myth of the all-powerful serial killer from the early and mid to late 90s that like Fincher also plays with in Seven. Yeah. And that, you know, really got going with like Silence of the Lambs. So he's got that kind of like, you know, he's just a completely insane, also like whatever, all kinds of movies in the 90s were all about serial killers and their kind of like omnipotence and their kind of preternatural ability to manipulate people. So, you know, that's another whole element in the film that like, I want this movie to be actually like a mini series or kind of a series, because like the world it creates is so rich and bizarre and weird that even putting it in 2.5 hours is really difficult, I think. So like it has a kind of, in a way that the first two movies don't. The first two movies are very self-contained, I would say. This movie is very expansive, and the fact that it's all condensed down really makes it way more confusing. Anyway.
I love that observation, because I think that it's hard, especially starting with Aliens, to not talk about the production of these movies along with their content, and the fact that it's such a fractured production and that this is an assembly cut. But I think I remember that part of in the original screenplay they were working from, it was a bunch of monks. So with that sort of lingers, but it's a bunch of monks on a wooden planet. So it really plays up the non-technological nature of the alien coming into this like totally organic, faith-filled environment. But so many of those sets, I believe, were already built. So they're using some of those at the same time. Then we have all the smelting plants. So that the hodgepodge of the story comes out of the production, but it also seems to serve it so well, because it becomes just like, it's the first two have their moments. I mean, definitely Alien has its moments of being meditative, and Aliens a little bit at the beginning of the cut we watched. But this whole thing, even in the action sequences, then becomes like a long meditation. The colors are the same. Everybody has the same haircut. There's the differences in rank are expressed largely in dialogue. Like, you can't, as Hillary said, it's hard to tell sometimes one from another. I love the meditative feel of it. Even the kills are sort of like, you aren't given a whole lot of, there's a lot of blood, but the kills aren't even particularly gory what you actually see. So it's just a lot of weird, gentle, violent implication.
I think I would be interested to hear, because one of the things that we said about the other movies is like, you know, that not only do we get, because they're these, you know, jumps in actual real lived time between each installment. So we get like kind of different historical sort of or conjunctural or whatever things happening in the movies as they go along. But we also get these kind of like genre shifts. I mean, and roughly, you know, from Alien, which is, as I think Matt was saying last time, like, you know, maybe really sort of like initiates the idea of the kind of sci-fi, a version of sci-fi horror that draws on the creature feature, but isn't exactly the creature feature, you know, to the action film that, you know, which also has kind of resonances with military sci-fi in certain kinds of ways. But like Aliens is like, you know, its science fictionalness maybe matters less in certain ways. So I am curious about how you all would identify the genre here, right? Because I think there and I wonder what you think about also, despite the fact that David Fincher disowned this movie, which is his first like post music video movie. I'm also curious about whether, you know, there are, because I like David Fincher, I've seen a lot of David Fincher movies, and I feel like people use his name as a director, and yet I am uncertain like what characterizes him as a director, but that just may be me. But I'm curious whether this has like David Fincher-ness in it. I mean, the serial killer thing is like one sort of thing to maybe think about there. Mm-hmm. And then I do think that there is a kind of effort here toward some version of science fictional world building. There really is not, I mean, the other two movies, I mean, you know, Alien is a ship movie, you know, and they go to the planet, and we talked a bit about how like the scene on the planet is extremely evocative, but it really, it stays kind of like at the level of evocation, right? That doesn't sort of turn into a whole world for us. I don't know whether that's a useful distinction or not. And we talked a lot last time about how Aliens is a planetary colonization movie. But again, like, you know, that's sort of us insisting on something that the movie doesn't do a ton of work toward bringing out or making, right? You know, like it mostly happens through implications, because it really is an action movie focused on like a pretty tight set of locations, right? They're not like, they don't roam all over the planet, for example. But here, like, we have this like, and then I guess the third thing besides like, does this seem like a David Fincher movie, and what do you think the genre is? The third thing I think is like, what do you make of the way that this world looks? Because that is something that I have some thoughts on, but it is like, this is a super strange looking movie. I mean, and it really, to my mind, like, it kind of mixes, there's a lot of like kind of mixed aesthetic stuff happening. And you know, there are these moments in it, I was thinking, particularly in the latter part of the movie, there are these moments when it's incredibly stagey. It's like being shot like they're on a stage set, you know, where so like, you know, Dylan will be preaching when they're in like whatever the room that they all decide that they can hang out in, which is like a very weird and hard to understand space. Dylan will be preaching, and then we'll see like a little cluster of guys over on one side who are like sitting, you know, like one guy's got his like hand on his fist, and you know, another guy's got his leg hanging over the edge of the balcony. I mean, it you know, it looks like a high school production of, you know, I don't know, a play.
Rent.
Our it looks Town. Like a high school production.
Alien of 3.
Yeah, Alien 3.
And
yeah.
That, like, that staginess is a really, to me, like, a very uncanny, like, element here. You know, if I decide that I want to be interested in it, as opposed to just thinking, like, what the fuck is going on here, you know? Just, like, so different from that kind of, we talked about with Alien, you know, just, like, the naturalness of those, of the interactions that the actors have, you know, the kind of, the sense of, like, spontaneity in their dialogue in Alien. And here we're, like, really in a very opposite, like, very mannered kind of world. Sorry, mm-hmm. that was a lot.
I think there's a lot to say about that. Maybe I'll pick up on the genre thing. I'll try to pick up on the genre thing first, because this is something I was trying to think of too. And I think one part of the difficulty of nailing down what generic hybrid is operating here, because I think in a certain way, this movie, just because of the nature of the penal colony and this double Y chromosome, these hyper-violent offenders, you have this like a penal colony that is also, it's a forced labor penal colony, right? So they are the foundry that creates these like, toxic waste, these panels to build toxic waste containment vessels or whatever. So it's a forced labor penal colony out of which has developed a kind of like a new religion, essentially, right? So it's not only, so the premise is that the penal colony or the foundry has been shut down. They're all still prisoners, but that they have formed a new religion and they have asked to stay there and be basically like caretakers to keep the pilot light lit, I think is one of the lines that is explained of why would they be allowed to stay here? Well, they need like some kind of skeleton crew, and the people who are self-selecting, they're the most religious fanatics of this new religion that Charles Dutton has invented, I guess, or that has synthesized out of this like this melange that that Clemens, the Charles Dance character, tries to explain to Ripley, and Ripley is like, oh, it's kind of like one of those, and he's like, yeah, one of those. So it's just, you know, they have this kind of skeptical view of religion in general, right? Anyway, I'm trying to talk about genre. So in that regard, it had more of a science fictional bent to me than Aliens did, because at least it's trying to like explain how the future might be radically different, or like a different society, you know, separated off. So like a prison colony, what would that look like under these circumstances? And what would the logic of social cohesion become in such a prison colony, where you are, where you have like administrators who are official, but there's only two of them. And at any given moment, the men could simply rise up and kill them. But to what end, right? Why would they do that? Because they can't be quote unquote free, any more free than they would be, because they're still on a colony with on a planet with no way out, right? So then this like religion emerges. And this is something we talk about with Stan's books, right? Like in Stan's books, in Kim Stanley Robinson's books, for people who are only listening to the Alien episodes, in Kim Stanley Robinson's books, it's often posited that we need some kind of new religion to kind of posit a future, a way toward looking toward the future or moving into futurity. And here it seems like that's a kind of science fictional aspect that's evolved in this moment, in this film, where a religion has cropped up to orient the prisoners into some kind of futurity that they don't have. You know, they will all eventually just die because there's no hope of getting off of this prison colony. So in that way, it's a kind of, I think that's the science, that's one of the big science fictional aspects of the film. And then the other genre, I mean, I think there's actually a lot of genres going in here, which is kind of what makes it postmodernistically difficult to synthesize again, as I say. One of them is the haunted house horror film, which also shades forward into kind of the torture porn films like Saw or whatever. And the other one is the prison escape film, but it's kind of an inverted prison escape film, because they're not really trying to escape. They're trying to protect a contagion from wiping out the prisoners. And then that's another genre of like, that's an emergent genre in the 90s of the contagion film. You know, which I think Soderbergh's Contagion is kind of the prime example of, but the kind of like anxiety, a film genre of the anxiety of new diseases and kind of new outbreaks. I think there's a movie called Outbreak. I think there's like that's a Michael Crichton movie, right? Anyway, there's like a kind of a sub genre, or maybe just a cycle of type of movies like that. So this is also in that kind of cycle. It, you know, all of these things just make it very difficult to pin this movie down in a way that's satisfying. But it's actually very satisfying to try to piece all this together. Mm-hmm. I think
one other genre to throw in the mix is it had big George Miller post-apocalypse vibes throughout. So even though we've got a supply ship coming every 6 months, everything is broken, everything is falling apart, and you're trying to just scrape by with whatever resources they have. Watching the oxen do their thing on this wasteland of a planet was depressingly hilarious. Like there's nothing happening, and even the oxen, you know, are I mean, obviously they're going to die when they become hosts for aliens, but they're obviously just drop shipped in. This doesn't, they don't seem to be, they don't seem, nothing, even the lice don't seem to be native to this planet. It's all being imported, whether intentionally or accidentally. And of course there's no Jonesy to eat the lice. So that's a constant problem throughout. But yeah, it is also a post-apocalypse movie, trying to survive, knowing you're going to die.
So that's really great. I mean, right. Because like one thing that we might think is that the question about being supplied on this planet, I think is actually a really vexing question. You know, like what are they bringing in that the oxen eat, or do they just not feed them until they die? That doesn't seem quite right. Because they have some discussion about how long the ox lives in that like slaughterhouse scene. There's a whole thing about supply here that I think is like kind of interesting, because why would Weyland-Yutani Corp be supplying them? Why wouldn't they just like let them die? You know, there's no reason not to. I mean, obviously they're like, you know, under a regime of the kind of like moderately slow death that like any prison is, you know. But so I think that is something that feels like it's worth thinking about. And I think I would want to connect that question about supply to Bill, you described it as you know, the sense of like this kind of quote unquote organic community, which, you know, is challenged by, if we think about like the religion as something new, like an importation, but nonetheless, there is some sense of like organic community. And so I'm just like thinking, well, the word organic is kind of is interesting there. And that, of course, like, you know, this also turns out to be the first of the alien movies that includes pregnancy, right? Includes the gestation of the alien understood to be a pregnancy. And, you know, like one thing that I think, it's also the first time that we see, well, we don't see it, but we by implication learn that Ripley has had sex with a man. And I think that that's important. And the question, like, and the whole Charles Dance character, I think is worth kind of investigating. But, you know, like, and there is a little bit of a kind of like uncertain misdirection in the movie in which we, I think at first, take her kind of Ripley's manifestation of certain symptoms that could be morning sickness to be the possibility that she's gotten pregnant from having sex with, what's his name?
Clemens.
I don't know much about Charles Dance.
Clemens? Yeah.
Our chief medical officer, former prisoner, barcode head.
Samuel L. Clemens.
Like Samuel Clemens.
Yeah. But then, of course, it actually turns out she is pregnant with an alien. And it seems to be the case that this manifests itself in a somewhat different way because it is, quote, a queen, something that is verifiable from the body scan, right? So then, you know, like, that kind of, so weirdly, because so much is going on in this movie, that can kind of feel like just one strain among many here, mm-hmm. I think. And obviously we would also want to link that thing about her getting pregnant to the way in which we get from that first shot that tells us the name of the colony, that it is like a, you know, whatever it is that the phrase is, inhabited, you know, inhabited only by double Y chromosome, blah, 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 blah. You know, we get a shift from in just like what you would think was heavy-handed if the movie seemed to be at all self-conscious about this, a shift from questions about gender to what we might call questions about sex, right? As in supposed quote-unquote biological or chromosomal sex, things which are, those are not really real things in the way that we take them to be real, but we get that kind of invocation. And then also other than the sort of like intimations of sexual assault when Ash attacks Ripley on the Nostromo, this is also the movie in which we see Ripley in danger of sexual assault and saved, in fact, by a man who maybe not incidentally is a Black man. I mean, the question about race is like, whoa, I don't even know what to do with that. So there's a whole kind of like line here in which we might want to think about like the organic, about sex and about gender. But again, like kind of like weirdly, which goes along with the idea that the alien is born out of an animal and therefore has different characteristics, which of course leads up to the famous, like, David Fincher wanted to put an alien costume on a whippet and use that instead of a puppet. And just like what really is one of the more bizarre, if that's really true, that's like a hilariously like childish thing.
There are pictures of the whippet wearing the costume, and it's also clear why the idea was quickly abandoned.
Turns out that's not that scary. Yeah. But then I want to say one other genre thing, and then I'll stop talking about this kind of like line of things. But something that I think is quite fascinating, just to like throw into the genre mix, because that sort of the apocalyptic, like the haunted house, you know, even like that pointing toward kind of like torture porn, horror, all of that is really, really, that is fascinating. And then it is also fascinating that an unused script for this movie was written by William Gibson. And you can actually, I've listened to like a like audio version of the script, extremely different. And there's something else to say about this, which is the early versions of the script make them a planet of communists, not a planet of prisoners. I think in the year of our Lord 1992, that is slightly hilarious and notable. But so that we get this, like, you know, the one version of the script anyway that's not used is written by the person who, like, quote unquote, invents cyberpunk, right? And like supposedly there's a novelization of that coming out, written by Pat Cadigan, who is, like, you know, probably the most famous like woman writer of cyberpunk. Forgive me if there are other ones, but, you know, like, so we have this kind of like cyberpunk legacy. And then we go through this series of like transitions through like the director who had the vision of it being all made out of wood and it would be like a monastery, into like whatever happens that gets David Fincher there, at which point it turns into steampunk, right? You know, like we have this just like, I mean, somebody even wears goggles at one point. And that, I mean, and those are aesthetic things. So maybe that is just to say that, like, Matt, you're saying like it's, you know, the sort of pomo-ness of the movie. Which goes along with our sense that this is like not a movie in which the viewer can like make a good cognitive map of things. Maybe that's all that is.
And but I think what's interesting to say about that, another thing that's interesting to say about that, and going off your great comment, is that in 1992, okay, so like William Gibson writes the initial screenplay. It's about space communists versus a corporation. That he's written that in 1987 or something. Then the Soviet Union falls, and all the producers and all the filmmakers look at each other and like, well, communism is a non-issue because history just ended.
Yeah.
Because now we're in the end of history, right? They fall directly into the trap that of the end of history. They fall directly into the end of history trap. And now they're looking around for like, well, how do we organize our thought, our cultural thinking around the future and what is going to happen to it? And what do they come up with? Celibate monks who are hyper-violent sex criminals, plus a serial killer, plus haunted houses, plus massive biological contagion that's going to wipe out humanity, plus like omnipotent corporations that only want to, you know, invest in bioweapons labs or something like that, right? So it's just, it kind of, once there's like no organizing anti-communism there or something, like once there's no communism to organize against, it's just like, it's all on the table now. We're just going to like, you know, every single idea, we're going to put it in there and we're going to ask different writers and directors to just make sense of it. And this is what you get. And this is why it's so, you know, and then what's the end of the film? The end of the film is, you know, Ripley commit suicide because for whatever, you know, because there's a queen growing inside of her, and like the prospect of something like the prospect of the future itself is too horrific to even face. So we're just going to commit suicide and like perhaps end the franchise. Although even as the film is being wrapped up, they're already planning yet another sequel, right?
And that gesture at the end, which is, of course, weirdly exactly the same thing that happens at the end of Terminator 2, right? You know,
but one even more Christ-like with the like full on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. the dive in. But you know, like, one, that might be finally the thing that, like, you know, hasn't happened yet, which is when, if we just like cross between like film universes, like when Ripley and like the robot, Ripley and the machine finally kind of like come together in mm-hmm. in some kind of way. But of course in Terminator 2, right, you know, Arnold has to lower himself into the fiery furnace in order to allow for the possibility of a future. And I think it's right here we supposedly see, you know, like this gesture that like is, you know, the anti-reproductive mm-hmm. futurity gesture, right? You know, that she, you know, not only because the company in the form of human Bishop in one of the strangest fucking touches in the movie. Why did he land on a planet wearing a trench coat and like a scarf, like he was going and like loafers or whatever? That whole thing is incredibly confusing. But the promise that he makes to her is like, oh, we can take it out of you, and you'll be able to have babies. And weirdly, like, there's no, we don't get any moment in which we think, but she already had a baby and the baby died when the baby was 65 years old. But nonetheless, like, that's the promise that he makes. And thus she rejects her own reproductivity as she is supposedly killing off the alien reproductivity.
Right.
As well.
I think one really interesting thing about that scene is that it's the movie's second assisted suicide. We have that really bizarre yeah. moment of Bishop and Ripley where she brings him, she's demonstrated, or Bishop has demonstrated in the previous movie that he's a self-aware individual. She brings this wrecked body back to life without a second ethical thought. They have their little conversation and then he's like, just very casually, hey, would you mind killing me? This is horrifying. And she's like, yeah, sure. And turns him off. And they're very different moments of kinds of assisted suicide. One is really kind of about stopping in a very small way about stopping the futurity of artificial life, which somehow gets really cashed out when we get real live Lance Henriksen to say, like, not only is Bishop dead, but Bishop is now like a fleshy person, but in the form of his designer. Lost my train of thought for the second thing. But yes, two weird assisted suicide scenes.
The question of euthanasia too is also raised briefly in the second Alien, in Aliens, where they're coming across like people, and they come across some either a woman or a man who is up in the goo, and they've got a thing growing in their chest, and they wake up long enough to say, "Kill me." So like that's another kind of common thread that's introduced to the Alien films, and a question of like, is it worth it to? Because Ripley, I feel like she knows that she's infected before she knows that she's infected. Mm-hmm. Somehow she's already kind of aware. She's like coughing. She's got this throat thing. And she's like feeling bad. So there's already like a hint there. So there's it raises the question of like, when is the right time to ask to be euthanized or something mm-hmm. like that? When, you know, like how far gone do you have to be to have like to request an assisted suicide or something?
Yeah. I really liked the opening scene where she's crawling with lice, like parasites are the first shot we have of her is parasites crawling all over the outside of her body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The lice are really interesting. The lice and the oxen are really interesting. And I do think that so they got rid of the monks and the idea that this would all be made out of wood, which again, I mean, I get that that might be a weird thing to do in space, but it is fascinating, right? And we seem to be we're on a planet that has an Earth type atmosphere, and also has non-lethal ocean water, right? Because like they kind of wade in and out of the ocean a bit. I got really distracted briefly thinking about that. But the kind of so I was thinking that having that opening scene, which is on the beach, you know, and there are these lines of lanterns that you can kind of tell are, you know, electric somehow, are not flames, but swinging, you know, swinging back and forth, and the oxen basically kind of in silhouette on the beach. I mean, it really like, which is not in the theatrical version, That has a very, it like brings you into, so the spaceship does then like kind of crash into this place that like somehow looks medieval, right? I mean, very like, rather than the sort of like aesthetic of the interior, which I do think, and I'm not using this word in a positive way, I do think is very steampunk, like, you know, so their clothes, which are a little bit steampunk, but are also sort of post-apocalypse clothes, because somehow, you know, in the post-apocalypse, it'll be like everybody would be wearing like ragged olive drab or whatever. But, you know, like the difference in that opening scene and then the kind of like rescue of Ripley and like the invocation of the lice also, which feels very like, you know, it still has this very kind of like sense of like the feudal in it, right? You know, that it feels like this kind of like medieval aesthetic. And I think that that's, you know, there's something about that that really kind of gripped me this time, because I think that the movie, yeah, like the problem of what it is that they're doing. So Matt, when you were talking like, oh, so they have to invent all these things because like it's turned out that like we're not gonna be able to power this plot through the specter of communism, even though I think it is arguable that it is still powered through the specter of communism, you know, simply like just inverted in some kind of way, right? Because like the most notable thing about this world is you can't tell anybody apart. Yeah. And like we were saying that before we started recording, we were saying, at least for me, like everybody in this movie is like a very facially distinctive person. And yet once things get going, I could not tell one from another, and I could not remember, is this the psychopath, is this like, you know, what sort of like craggy gnarled off-center nose guy is,
right,
is this, you know, that felt very like confusing. But so there is a kind of specter of like egalitarianism, right? And then I think that the whole mode of the movie is weirdly to go from, you know, aliens, where we get on the one hand, we seem to be seeing like essentially like up to date to the moment of the film's production military tech, right? But on the other hand, like we are definitely wedded to a sort of like technological future, you know, technological futurity is what we're getting there, if there's a version of the future, right? This movie is like, it is the residuum, you know, in every way, like the kind of work that they're supposedly doing, that they are like this little band left behind on this planet that clearly no longer plays any sort of useful function, if it ever did. You know, that they have this like sort of monk-like quality, their religion, probably, yes, invented by Dylan, but is, you know, essentially like a sort of residual, like social binding force. The way that things look, you know, which oddly echoes like the interior of the Nostromo, like the lower decks of the Nostromo, but rather than they're, I think, suggesting a kind of like historical conflict in the that emerges, you know, like, the sort of like wreckage of the boom period of capital that emerges in the 70s. Here we get that aestheticized into this kind of like steampunk looking thing, but it can't get rid of the sense of this is just like residuum, you know, like the leftoverness. So on the one hand, the movie has to like invent like, you know, the American prison industrial complex in order to produce like what it can think about. Not that it really invented it, but you know, like, oh, we can't use communism, hey, prison, you know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like everything in it is telling us like this is the left behind, right? You know, in its like feudalism and the fact that they're fucking oxen there, even that the alien comes out more animal like. Which is really something that I did not get watching this movie the first two times, other than it goes kind of on four. Yeah, I totally did not understand that. I had to read that was the conceit of it before, yeah, I got that. Anyway, so animality, residuums, blah, 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 something.
It doesn't seem to be eating them, but I do think its kills are very different in this movie. They're lingering kills. There's a lot of like chewing and mutilating of bodies, whereas they're efficient killers. It's kill for the sake of killing, and it doesn't exactly seem like it's eating. But I think that ties into something you were talking about earlier on the supplies, and the fact that we do get a scene. We get the scene of the oxen in the slaughterhouse, but also in the slaughterhouse is a whole shelf of chickens in cages. So we're not seeing them, like, they're not egg laying chickens. These aren't breakfast food chickens. They just exist in the slaughterhouse. I mean, I'm guessing to be killed. It's not about bringing more life into the world. It's about the turning of bodies into consumable meat resources. Again, just like this theme of animality is it's pervasive.
That's weird because then we get this like both like the oxen, you know, like what are they pulling around with teams of oxen? Like that is profoundly confusing to me, which also suggests that like even just like the presence of the oxen not only signifies the past, it also like itself is just residual. Like what are they doing with it? They just are here, you know? But then Bill, what you just said, that suggests like a little bit of like, oh, the prison and like the factory farm are both here. If in a kind of weird margin.
Oxen aren't used to haul oxen. Like we see the men hauling that big ass oxen on a cart into the room. So, I mean, they're clearly doing some work, but the part of the work is not hauling enormous 800-pound animals into the slaughterhouse.
I mean, that it just speaks to the baffling question of like, what are they doing here? Like keeping the pilot light lit. That's based like they're caretakers of a defunct factory, and they've created a religion to justify their continued subjugation to these two guys, Andrews and Aaron. Aaron is the underling. Andrews is, I didn't know their names either. I couldn't understand what they're saying. I had to put on the subtitles because like also the audio mix was terrible. Like it was just ridiculous. I mean, because there's just like these echoing caverns that you can't really understand with their thick like Cockney accents or whatever they are. baffling, just very strange decision-making. But yeah, what do they do? Like how, like they get supplied every 6 months. So then the rest of the time they have to be farming and like raising chickens or not, like it's truly baffling. The religious aspect, I don't know. I don't want to be jumping all over the place, but it's something I was thinking of. The religious aspect is also baffling because the only person who really seems to believe in the religion is Charles Dutton, is like Dylan himself. Like he gives these sermons and stuff and people listen to him. But then when it comes time to, when there's a woman present, a bunch of guys get together, even though they've all taken this vow of celibacy and they've all elected to stay on the planet because they believe in this religion so much, they like immediately try to like rape her. And the only thing that stops them is Dylan coming in with a big, with a crowbar and beating the shit out of them. So how good is this religion at creating a cohesive polity or social society or whatever, right? Like he literally beats that one guy it seems like he beats him to death. Like he's got brain on the end of his crowbar once he's done smashing him. So just utterly like confusing and like it didn't make sense.
Well, it's great because it's like an assembly cut life, right? Like everything is pieces of a life that doesn't come together. The religion is pieces of a religion that I would say that I'm not even sure that Charles S. Dutton is a believer in his own faith. He understands that it's like an ordering principle.
It helps.
But I don't know that I don't know that it's a belief structure, but it's all like there's no full sketch of a life. It's some chickens awaiting butchering, it's oxen who don't really have a job, it's a religion that isn't really a religion, it has adherents that aren't really adherents, it has a social structure of managers and prisoners that isn't really an active social structure. It's all just pieces of something that look like it could come together.
I mean, you know, one thing, I mean, like the Charles S. Dutton character is fascinating. And I mean, one thing that we can think is, so he is Yaphet Kotto reborn in a form appropriate to this, you know, like extremely weird mess of a movie from 1992, in which instead of being a worker, you know, in need of a union with more members than just Harry Dean Stanton, he's a prisoner, right? This, you know, and in which like in which the creation of solidarity, rather than being kind of organic in the way that I think that it is in Alien, you know, like the solidarity between Brett and Parker comes out of the precisely out of the role that they play and their position in a hierarchy. Here I mean, like the question of hierarchy and like how power works, you know, how hierarchical power works, aside from whatever question, you know, like, because domination, as we said earlier, is really not kind of on the table here. So the question of how the hierarchy works, in some ways, what Dylan does is to maintain the hierarchy, just as when, you know, Andrews or whatever is dead, and so is Clemens, and nobody wants poor old 85, you know, the dum-dum, who really is just like naive. He's just like, you know, Mr. False Consciousness, basically. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants him to be the leader. You know, Dylan is like, Ripley, you do it. You're an officer, right? You do it. Which isn't that, I think that's kind of interesting. But the other thing about that character is like, if this was like a quote unquote realistic prison movie, you know, he'd be like a Black nationalist. He'd be like, you know, he'd be a Black Muslim. He'd be like, and his constituents would not be this, all these like white British guys. And there are, I think, two other Black guys there. One of whom gets killed earlier, one of them gets killed later. You know, and what he would be preaching would be like something somewhat different, right? And actually more contentful, because his preaching is like extremely non-contentful.
It's
like
very
that is
weird.
That is like a big sign of it. And you know, even he's got like the horn-rim glasses on, yep. You know, like he's visually clearly meant to evoke, right, you know, Malcolm X, or like, you know, your generic fantasy of like the Nation of Islam preacher, right? Like and you know, and I mean, that's just like, that is really weird. You know, that's like a really weird part of the movie. And also, you know, Charles Dutton is like playing this role with like a level of intensity that, you know, it's not that he seems to be in a different movie than other people, but like, you know, he really stands out. And then that makes the whole like question about like race in the movie like really weird, you know. Really, really strange, which is clearly only resolved by having him die, right? I mean, because like one guy stays alive.
Yeah.
I don't know which guy it is.
I think his name is Morse. I think it's Morse.
I think that's
alive.
Right. Yeah.
Morse, but I don't know who he is or what his deal is.
No.
Like,
no. And that scene toward the climactic scene where they're going to like get the alien into the piston. And right. So they have to run through these hallways and close the doors. It is both awesome and one of the most confusing, like you can't tell whether a guy did it right or did it wrong. Like
this is symptomatic of the complete breakdown of classical Hollywood style, where like geography is utterly confusing. And when you mentioned, Billy, earlier you said that the whole movie is meditative. I didn't think it was meditative at all, because I thought it was completely frantic because of that David Fincher editing, like music video editing style. Like we don't ever get like one of these long tracking shots through the facility to let us know exactly where things are and like kind of how the geography is laid out. It's just even like any of the tunnels are just like, where are they in relation to each other? Where do these men sleep? Where do they eat? Where does anything happen? Everything's just happening all over the place, except for there's like the office where Andrews and Aaron are hanging out, which I don't know where that is in relation to anything. I don't know where the escape pod is being stored in relation to the cistern, in relation to the piston, in relation to the foundry. Like, I don't know where any of this stuff is. It's absolutely baffling and confusing. The Charles Dutton speeches, his sermons are always, it's like, oftentimes it'll take place after somebody dies, right? He'll be like, we're here to give thanks. We're rejoicing in the apocalypse. We're doing all these things. It's very like the ideological function of these speeches, which some of the speeches are sermons, some of them are eulogies, and some of them are come after, I think right after Andrews comes in and delivers his rumor control. Here are the facts, yeah, right? Yeah. So this mm-hmm. kind of like, this is the official story. You need to get on board with it. Andrews delivers his speech, and then he steps aside and Dylan steps in to this role of this charismatic preacher who then kind of delivers, like reinforces that, yes, this is the line we're all going to follow so that we can maintain some semblance of civility, even though we are all genetically murderers, right? And this is how we're going to like keep living one more day. And then that is the movie wants this to be the stakes of the moment when they decide to stand up for themselves and like fight the alien, because he gives this other speech where it's like, we're all going to die. Are we going to die standing up or on our knees? We're all going to go, you know, whether we go to heaven or not, blah, 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 this kind of thing. So the question, again, it's kind of another harkens back to the euthanasia question. How do you want to die? How do you want to die fighting, or do you want to die running away or whatever? I don't know.
Yeah, I like that, man. I think a couple of thoughts. I think that question, you know, you're going to die. How do you want to die? Is I think part of that, and what you're talking about as a sort of franticness in the movie. I think that is the stuff that makes it meditative. Like in Scott and Cameron, Cameron especially, but the storytelling is caught up in the visuality. There's like a sensible geography in Alien. There's a sensible geography in Aliens. And even though Cameron is like giving us much more scope in the geography, he's really careful in making sure that it all puts together. And even and especially because in the final scene with the elevators that we talked about last time, you need to understand how that facility works. I think what makes it meditative is that there's no spatial orientation. There's no temporal orientation. There's no social orientation. You cannot really place yourself at any moment in what this movie is doing. I think even in the studio cut, but most especially in the assembly cut. So a lot of the experience, at least for me, of watching the assembly cut was you have to, or at least I had to let go of the cue seeking, the kinds of storytelling that Scott and Cameron gave us, because it is really just an unfolding. It has a sort of plot, it has a sort of beginning, middle, and an end, but it's really, it almost starts in media res and leaves in media res. And one of the biggest changes, in fact, if I remember right from the theatrical, is that like the queen is being born as Ripley falls into the furnace. Mm-hmm. There's nothing, like she's just in and vaporized at the end of this. So it's just such a like gentle in, gentle out. And I agree that it's frantic, but it's also just, I mean, to quote the kids, it's a mood more than either of the other two is.
I mean, you know, yeah, so I feel like there's one version of it that in which clearly like what we need to sort of like interrogate here, whether like as movie or as sort of like capturing or mediating a particular like historical moment, is this kind of question of the postmodern, particularly in the mode of like radical disorientation, right? As well as it's not pastiche, but whatever, when you like lump like a bunch of different aesthetics together and you want the aesthetic is expected to do a lot of work for you, but it's also just, you know, reference, 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 right? So, you know, one thing is like, we're just like lost in the lobby of the Hotel Bonaventure, but instead it is like on another planet and the aesthetics are weirdly like Victorian, right? That, I mean, that's, you know, and I think that that's there. And then I guess I would want to say like, if we want that to be the kind of dominant description of the movie, which I think like there are a lot I think there are a lot of possible ways to think about what's happening. But if we stayed with that, then we really have this kind of question of like, what do we make of the sort of the specific storyline around the alien, right? So alien birth, one that, you know, the way that it hangs on to the escape ship is not surprising, because I think we are now familiar with the idea that the alien is good at doing that. Just like Ripley is always good at being in the escape ship and not dying, you know, the alien is also good at that. But like the birth out of an animal that produces another stage, another kind of transformation, right? And, you know, and makes it into something that like eats, in, as opposed to just like killing people, right? And also, you know, version two of human alien unspoken agreement is, you know, or the human having to meet the eye of the alien, right, is the alien not killing Ripley because it knows. So smelling her, right?
Right.
And at that moment, unlike the, you know, the more sort of like, oh, hey, we just made a bargain or we made a contract, which happens in Aliens, the contract that Ripley immediately violates. Here, right, it sniffs her and it's like, oh, you're one of my kind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some ways, like her decision to end her life and the life of the queen by jumping into the fiery furnace is like an assertion that she's not one of the alien's kind, right? And that tells us like the kind of like, okay, here's the like, you know, here's what it is to be human. It's not that like you care enough that when you're in peril for your life, you're going to rescue Jonesy. What it is to be human is to have like this ultimate sort of like agential stake in your own life, right? Or to know your personhood sufficiently that you can decide to like end your personhood or something. But it's weird to have like, and then, you know, Bill, your sense of it is like, you just have to, you know, like this almost like anti-plot movie, you know, like in which you're just are lost in like this series of repetitive happenings, which maybe has something to do with like the theatricality of it in certain scenes, which is not there in other scenes. I would wonder about how both of those ways of thinking about it, and maybe also my saying like it's all about, this is about the residual, you know, it's about the historically residual. I wonder what all of those things have to do with the fact that this is the pregnancy movie, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what we've been waiting for the whole time, when like, you know, it's like real pregnancy this time, you know. And it's also the movie, you know, it's also the movie where like Ripley hooks up with someone, you know. And of all people, Charles Dance, who I feel like everything I can think of seeing him in, which I feel like is maybe like BBC TV dramas, I feel like he always plays like an authoritarian, like an upper crust authoritarian asshole. And in this movie, it's very hard. I mean, maybe that's just because that's what I associate his face with. But like, you don't trust him at all, right? I mean... And
he has sent so many people in so many movies to their deaths that as soon as you see him, even at this point, but certainly like from Game of Thrones on backwards, he's killed thousands.
He's Tywin Lannister, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Lannister, but he's also in Last Action Hero, the villain in Last Action Hero.
That's right. That's right.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger, have you seen Last Action Hero, Hillary?
I don't think I ever have. No,
you really should see Last Action
Hero. It's a special piece of work. Yeah,
you know, I love Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Going back to Charles Dance and Clemens at the beginning, and like his whole vibe, which is always off, which is like, why would she? The fact that she's horny in the first place is baffling to me.
Baffling.
She's like, I've been out here for a long time. I've been out here for a long time. He's like, so have I. Like, yeah, but you've been like being hunted by mindless killer aliens. Like, okay. So I mean, the heart wants.
Doctors can always get it. That's what we learn here.
That's true. So, his vibe is always off, right? So she doesn't even trust him when he says Newt drowned in her cryo tube or whatever. So she demands that he do an autopsy right in front of her. Yes. And we get glimpses of that, right? Which is another feature of David Fincher, like 90s Fincher, like this kind of like, you know, quick cut music video editing of like hyper gore, looking forward to the Saw movies and the kind of torture porn stuff. And just like the increasing amount of gruesomeness and like explicit violence that we see through the 80s, but then it really exploding in the 1990s. He then understand the fact that she makes him crack her chest and like look into Newt's, you know, chest cavity, clues him into the fact that, you know, she is looking for something that's not just cholera, which is what she tells him, like it's a cholera outbreak. He says, but this is a kind of a sidebar. He says there hasn't been a recorded case of cholera in 200 years, which makes me wonder like how long Ripley has been out there. If she thought that cholera could potentially be a real reason for him to do an autopsy, which never indicated how long she's out there. And then of course, Bishop too shows up and says, I'm the designer of Bishop. Lance Henriksen looks younger than Lance Henriksen in 1986, 1982. So it's just really confusing and baffling on that whole timeline issue. Right. But then he's kind of accepts the fact that, she convinces him more or less that there's something bigger that we need to be worried about these corpses. And then that gets him on her side against Andrews and Aaron, who wants to keep the bodies on ice. She wants to cremate them, all this kind of like struggle, right? This kind of just weird, it takes a lot of concentration to kind of parse the kind of unspoken rivalries between the doctor and the administrator, right? Then of course, Charles Dance, I feel like I'm monologuing, but Charles Dance, Clemens has this mysterious history. Like, why are you here? You're the medical officer, but you've got a barcode. You were a prisoner, but now you're not. You elected to stay here on purpose. We finally get, he's got one of these, I was a cop and I killed a kid stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Except he was a doctor and he was addicted to morphine. Is that right?
Morphine. Yeah.
He was addicted to morphine in the year 2525 or whatever.
Speaking of 200 years, yes.
Yeah. And he killed 11 kids who were injured in a bus crash or some shit like that, right? And
too much painkiller.
Yeah, he gave them too much painkiller. And the reason that he is elected to stay on this prison colony is A, he was interned there before and he grew to like them, even though he doesn't respect their cockamamie religion. But really the underlying issue is that the underlying reason that he's staying is he's self-penitent. You know, he thought he got off easy for killing these 11 kids. And by electing to stay here, he is punishing himself, right? Because the state won't do it adequately. So it's down to the individual to punish yourself, to feel guilty. Even then, though you're exonerated, right? And the form that guilt takes is staying here and being a chief medical officer, all these like weird freaks. And at that exact moment, as he's like injecting her with something else, which I thought was going to be a sedative, but wasn't, he gets fucking totally fucked up by the alien. and then lets Ripley go. And then Ripley runs to the meeting that Andrews is having. And as she gets there, she goes, it's here. And Andrews gets fucked up.
In a piece of good timing.
At exactly the moment that Andrews is delivering rumor control, saying Golic is the one who killed these guys.
Right.
There's no alien. Don't worry about it. And then the alien kills him. It's wonderful, like comedic irony, like temporal irony there.
It's also a cool moment where we've had this sort of reliable white-walled dining scene in the past three movies, but it's also been like the only place where you're safe. And Fincher violates that space now. Not only is we have the communal dining room again, but now the alien's so scary he can even come to get you when you're all together in the white room. No other place in any of the three movies has a white room except for the dining area. Mm. And then it becomes red in Alien 3.
I mean, I guess one thing that we might think is, because it is inexplicable on many levels, that that Ripley wants to hook up with Charles Dance.
Clemens.
Jesus Christ. Except that then we might again think, you know, we might again think that, like, you know, one, so, you know, here we're just on this terrain of, like, sex as chromosomal identity, right? Linked inherently to violence. And also it seems like on this planet, right, you know, a certain fear about, like, desire in general and sexual desire in particular is revealed, which is that, like, desire is either the animal and the human, or maybe worse than that, that there's a kind of automaticity to it, right? That it turns you into an automaton, right? So, like, it's inexplicable. Why would Ripley say this? It makes absolutely no sense, because on top of everything else, like, she's not feeling very well. I mean, you know, like, and also she just, like, you know, the last guy who she was attracted to just, like, got, you know, immolated or tossed out into space or whatever they did.
The last guy whose first name she knew.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and, like, she is a sensible person and also a survivor. And here she's like, oh, yeah, you know, let's have sex, Mr. Man who has a barcode on the back of his neck, which I know she hasn't seen it yet at that point, but come on. And two, who has been injecting me with something that he calls, like, a cocktail of his own devising.
Yeah!
Like, obviously, she's not going to, like, consent to that. But so, you know, like, I mean, something in the logic here is, like, not only are the sort of, like, bonds of the oath of celibacy supposedly enough to wed these men to staying on this fucking quote unquote planet, right? which is, you know, basically a beach and what I think is a very large building.
Yeah.
And that's, like, it, right? Not only is that, does that bond, you know, weaken so quickly that they turn into rapists right away, right? Which of course has to fulfill both, like, you know, a fear and a fantasy on the part of the viewer, but also the same thing happens to Ripley, right? I mean, and that might, and again, I think this is a way in which, like, this movie, which becomes much more sort of, like, in one way, apparently blatant about, like, the peril and vulnerability of the feminine, right? On the other hand, actually is perhaps really about the sort of, like, peril and vulnerability. You know, really, it's, like, not about, like, sex/gender at all, but about, like, the sort of human vulnerability to others, right? To desire itself, something like that, right? Like, which is a weird place to take the kind of, like, and now you're gestating a queen from, right? But there's something in there of, like, her having been turned into something that she wouldn't have been otherwise, right? You know, I don't know. I mean, but that sort of, like, how it is that kind of, like, story sits with the rest of what's going on in the movie, I think remains, like, a really weird question. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, because, yeah, like, Matt, you were saying, like, they don't need the state to keep them in prison. They keep themselves in prison. And again, like, there doesn't seem to be a state. There's just Weyland-Yutani Corp. And one of the weirdest things in all of the things that are weird in this movie is when they're standing inside whatever giant brick chimney or whatever area it is that has, like, a big, you know, like, apparently cylindrical walls of brick going up. We have, Asian lettering kanji characters going up the side of the brick, right? You know, just like a little bit of like Blade Runner style orientalism. Clearly it's like a call out to the, I assume, the Yutani side of Weyland-Yutani Corp. And then when the highly mysterious representatives of the corporation arrive, most of whom are in the same spacesuits that Ripley gets into at the end of Alien, that look like they're made out of a very nice sort of channel quilted cotton fabric, strangely enough. One of whom is Lance Henriksen. Yes, looking like he's had some great skincare. He's just stepped out of a salon. His hair is like,
looks fabulous.
Fabulous, you know, like totally holds up under the wind. But the first one we see is an unnamed Asian appearing man wearing wacky sunglasses.
Reflective glasses
that screen his eyes from us, yet I believe he has like an accent of some kind. And I think he's wearing a lab coat, maybe. I mean, he's a cartoon evil Asian scientist. And he just, you know, he shows up and has like, bizarrely enough, a little bit of dialogue.
Yeah.
And so like, he's the future arriving. And in that way, it's 1992, but we're still like, you know, why we're still obsessed with the idea of like, you know, the Japanese are going to take over. I don't know what's happening there, but those
more,
two things,
more residual, like, that's more residual.
Or more, right. Stuff. More residual, right.
Cause it's residual from like the design of those, of that character is also, and of Lance Henriksen is straight from Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Both yes, of those yes, guys. Exactly. Right. Deckard, mm-hmm. Deckard's they're, pension.
They're, yeah, yeah. Their costumes.
Yeah. Lance Henriksen is a little bit more 90s because he yeah. does have like the shoulder. It's Mulder. A little bit, you know, those coats that Mulder wears on the X-Files.
Hell yeah.
The X-Files. And actually Scully does too. It was yeah. a, you know, gender neutral trench coat era.
It is sort of great when Lance Henriksen shows up and he's got his face covered as though the movie's trying to not let you know who that is. But we see the Henriksen hairline, like yeah. you're covering up the wrong part of the head to hide this individual from us.
The outline is unmistakable.
Yeah. I wanted to add one small thing on this idea of sex across the four Sigourney right. Weaver Alien movies, which is it's definitely on a trajectory. And in the next movie, it's a weird scene, but she actually hooks up with the alien queen, which as you track from like the vague intro, the whatever maybe vague connection there is with Tom Skerritt and Alien is elevated a bit with the Michael Biehn relationship. She actually has sex with a human in Alien 3 and then really hits that peak in Alien 4, which, you know, more conversation for next time, but I was thinking of it while we were talking about it. She's on sex and Ripley is a wild trajectory across these movies. And it's, you know, it's not really a trajectory maybe because we're dealing with four directors. I actually think I remember some, it maybe was Fincher. It could have been Cameron. No, I think it was Fincher who was saying that Sigourney Weaver to come back said she wanted there to be no guns in the movie and she wanted Ripley to have sex with the alien queen. And I think it was Fincher. He was like, okay, we're not doing the queen thing, but let me see what I can do for you on the guns. And then when Alien Resurrection came out, I believe, again, if it was Fincher, he did an interview saying, well, you know, she finally got what she wanted.
I was just also, there is a like in Lance Henriksen showing up and saying, I'm Bishop's creator, which is a huge, I mean, you know, Matt, you were saying like, we don't know how long Ripley has been out there and I am Bishop's creator. Just like what a wild, insane, just like, you know, the confusion of generation here, generations just like is extraordinary. But that is also pointing us ahead, I would say, to Prometheus and then to Covenant. Yeah. In which like the question of like who made the android, you know, Bishop has already raised it himself when he asks Ripley to end his worse than bare life condition that he's in, his like really minimal condition that he's in, because he says like, well, they could get me going again, but I'd never be top of the line, which weirdly is a very Ash Like, it's a very Ash thing to say, you know, and it echoes with the idea of the alien as like this perfect organism, right? And, you know, Bishop mm-hmm. is like, if I'm not going to be perfect artificial person,
right?
You know, if I'm not going to be the best, and top of the line suggests the most saleable model, right? You yeah. know, like the presence of mm. like the and they call them in this movie, they call them droids.
Yeah.
Yes, picture R2-D2 mm-hmm. every time. But which, why is R2-D2 a droid? Never made sense. But leaving that aside, like the idea of like Bishop as a commodity, you know, interesting. It's interesting that that kind of like emerges here, and then we see his "I am his creator." Strange. I mean, so that's maybe like a step away from the corporate robot into some other, both the doppelganger and then like the commodity form.
I remembered Lance Henriksen being Wayland in this movie, but in fact, he's not. He's Wayland in the Alien versus Predator, but he goes unnamed in this movie. And I think that is exactly what you're talking about, is what's so fascinating about this one tiny moment in the Alien universe, is that it is the first moment of non-corporate roboticization, which gets in Prometheus and Covenant, just gets, you know, the robot gets pulled right back into that. And it's the through line of those two movies. But the fact that he goes unnamed, I mean, I don't even feel like in the assembly cut, it's implied that he's Wayland. He's mm-hmm. just the guy who made the droid, maybe. But yeah, the namelessness of that, the resurrection of Bishop in that moment. And also the fact that he's enfleshed, but then also given no name. It's an absolutely bizarre moment, even though this representative, I mean, maybe it's doing double action here, because as he is just then a representative of the company, somebody who makes droids. So he's in some way, wow, weirdly, maybe the Lance Henriksen human character becomes the corporate robot again. Oh, he's just a human corporate robot.
Right. Cause he's kind of dressed like Paul Reiser.
Yeah. I was going to say he's a proto Paul Reiser.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, so the villain, the human villain, or the corporate villain, or whatever, the I don't know, the real, the figure that betrays humanity in favor of the alien and in favor of the corporation across these three movies, right? We move from Ash, the robot, to then Ash gets displaced onto Bishop, and Bishop has been sort of neutered as the robot, as the malevolent robot. But then the malevolence has been displaced onto Paul Reiser as the fully corporate robot. And also, like, I was thinking about this back on this, Reiser's character, Burke, is actually not operating on behalf of the corporation. He's actually betraying the corporation. If you listen to the dialogue and how he explains it, he's taking his own initiative to send these colonists to the ship to get the thing without going through the red tape that the corporation would require.
Wow.
So that he can put a claim on this thing and get rich personally. So it's a continuation of Ripley is the good worker who's trying to follow the regulations, and he's trying to cut corners to enrich himself.
Wow.
At the expense of the company. I think if you watch Aliens and you watch just his dialogue, that emerges. It's not underscored at all, but that is kind of what the plot that he is trying to lay out, that he's trying to conspire with Ripley to both. He's like, we can both get rich off of this. He's not saying the corporation can get rich. We can both get rich. The villain again. So who's the villain in Alien 3? Again, this is a problem with the confusion of the film. Charles Dance, Clemens at the beginning seems to be hiding something. Ripley is suspicious of him, that he's hiding something about Newt's death, right? Is Clemens aware of the alien, and is he operating on behalf of the bioweapons division? Turns out, no. Okay, well then who is? Well, unwittingly, the psychopath Gallic falls in love with the dragon and must see him again. That's who releases the alien from the confinement, right? So then he is duly punished by being eaten by the alien, right? He's a psycho. He's this weird serial killer. And then the resurrection of Bishop in the enfleshed Bishop designer, who his speech is extraordinarily seductive. He's telling Ripley, I'm not Bishop. I designed Bishop. The company thought that you would respond well to a familiar face. You can come back. You can have children. We can get it out of you. It's very Luciferian in a way. It's very like, you know, Faust. You can make this it's a Faustian bargain. You can make this arrangement with us and we will save your life. But all we ask is for you to give us the queen, right? He's then beaten over the head by Morse, I think, or Aaron, with a like a fire extinguisher or something, like really brutal. And he's like, "I'm not a robot," and he's bleeding like red blood. But his ear, his whole side of his face is like falling off in a weird, synthetic human-y kind of way. So even that is like a very strange, like it looks really horrible. And it's like, you're like, there's no way a human being could like have his head open like that and still be yelling at Ripley. So still all very like uncanny and odd about like, yeah, the dynamics of evil and like how they survive like these attacks and like what their approach to getting Ripley on their side is and what their motivations and relationship to the company are, all of this stuff. But it's increasingly displaced and like scattered in this Alien 3, right? Like who those evil actors are.
Yeah, that's amazing. I like that. And also, I mean, the other thing about him yelling that while his head is coming apart is like, he's not hitting you because he thinks you're a robot. And also, Ripley isn't refusing because she thinks you're a robot. Like whether you're a robot or not is 100% not at issue.
Right.
Like, you know, why are you yelling? I'm a human being. I mean, you know, we know why, because like what he really means is I'm not the corporation, but of course he is the corporation.
Right.
I mean, we also still at this point, like, and I mean, I will continue to maintain that this is one of the best parts about these movies. Like, we still don't know why Weyland-Yutani wants the alien anyway. Because if it is for the bioweapons division, who are they fighting with?
Right.
Or if what they're doing, if they're just a weapons manufacturer, right? Or if they have a weapons manufacturing division, right? You know, if this is like Boeing or whatever, then like, who are they selling? Who do they imagine they'll sell these things to? You know, like, are there warring corporations? Is that what it is? Like, are there states they're selling them to? Like, what, you know, and the like the incoherence of that, like why it would be that they would want this thing that is so obviously like not a good thing to want, because it's obviously like not going to be easily brought under control because of this whole problem of being good at surviving, which, you know, seems both like that should be really well attuned to what a corporation is and also is really not, you know, like even here, as we have begun to realize that the alien can just like change its form, right? You know, even in its echoes with Capital, like it does, it, you know, it doesn't totally like fit the bill, but whatever, that is still just unclear, you know, that we really don't know why, you know, or why they would send this like very odd group of people on a, you know, to like get Ripley and the alien back, you know.
The only thing the only thing that we actually know that any military group does is hunt bugs, which we get that one sort of throwaway line in Aliens. So the only thing within the universe that they might do with these alien bioweapons is throw them at other non-human aliens.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And yet we see no sign. Everybody's so surprised and so doubtful that there is such alien life.
That they even exist.
We get that thing. We get Bill Paxton joking about like having sex with
the Arcturian Poontang.
Right.
Yeah, thank you. But that's as close as we get, and we don't really know what that means. I mean, we know what that means, you know, it's like a Vietnam War thing or whatever, but like we don't know what it means in terms of like, are there like alien species? I mean, I also think, you know, something, this movie, in all of the weird things that it does, like at least one thing that it is it's really like, it's really intent on being anti-utopian. And I think that is where the anti-communism of the original script that became script that became script that became script. And even the my imagined version with the monks in the place all made of wood, like, you know, that I think is a line of continuity there, right? You know, we simply cannot believe that these, you know, and the reason that we can't believe that this actually is the community that it appears to be, and it's not even the community of the Nostromo, right? It's not even that place, is one, I think we can't believe it because there's not a proper hierarchy, right? And therefore we have to look for the ways in which there is a secret hierarchy, or we have to think it's perpetuated by ideology. It can't actually be sort of egalitarian in the way that it seems to be. And two, because here, you know, I think we're on the terrain of the human is, you know, the animal, right? The animalistic, the urge, instinct, all of this stuff is what's going to come out. However much evidence we have that, like, now the human is like just like a much weirder thing than that, that surely cannot in any way be reduced to the instinctual, because we're in a world where there are aliens and androids and, you know, all of these other things. Like, that is, I think, something consistent in the terrain in the terrain of this movie.
I liked what you said about that it's anti-utopian, and that's where the kind of anti-communist energy goes into at one moment. And it's kind of out of context, and it doesn't necessarily directly relate what you're saying, but Ripley is trying to convince Aaron that the company is not going to come down and save them. If anything, they're going to kill. Well, they just want the thing for the bioweapons lab. We have to destroy it now. We have to get it in the furnace. Aaron says, fuck no, they're going to come and rescue us. I have a wife and kids. I want to go home to them. She grabs him by the shoulders and says, there are no alternatives. She gives the Margaret Thatcher line. Now, she's not talking about capitalism being no alternative, but the fact that that line is there, is she's not talking directly about that, but it's like sideways. Like, she literally says, there are no alternatives. Yeah. We can only do this one thing. And then that's when she, sort of reveals or comes to the conclusion that she is infested with the queen, and that again, communication is somehow happening, that this is a cognizant life form, that it will not kill its future, that I contain the future of this being, and it will not kill its future. Subsequent to that, she's speaking with Dylan. And this is one of the most striking moments of the film stylistically, in a moment that is filled with very strange film style. She looks directly at the camera and says, I need you to kill me. She's speaking both to Dylan, but she's speaking somehow to the audience, yeah, which is very curious. Like, I don't understand what role we're supposed to play in, you know, killing Sigourney Weaver, killing Ellen Ripley, ending the Alien franchise. I need you to kill me. Dylan says, go kill yourself. Fuck you. Go kill yourself. She then gives this big long speech about the her original crew being expendable, the Marines being expendable, and she's giving the speech to all of the people, convincing them to fight. Now you will be expendable. The company does not care about you. They will not come to save you. They may kill you just for even knowing about it. They think we're crud.
Yeah, weird.
I mean, one of the worst insults you could ever be hurl at another human being is crud. So, like, that kind of that sense of humanness and humanity of you want to say it's completely depoliticized just because of the complete lack of even just anti-communism there. It's just purely anti-utopian, and the kind of instrumental rationality of the capitalist corporation with nothing to resist it other than the fact that this, you know, the phrase we all say nowadays, the revolutionary call to action, I'm not crud. but that's what finally gets them to decide to die fighting.
Yeah.
God don't make no crud.
God don't make no crud.
Yeah, that is a really weird moment that like, why would that be the line?
It's bizarre. Utterly baffling that they would use the word crud.
It would be way better if
they've been saying fuck and shit and like all the bad words. Exactly. Maybe Sigourney Weaver just didn't want to say whatever curse word they had.
No guns. I want to have sex with an alien queen, and I'd prefer not to swear.
Yeah.
She should have said lice.
They think we're lice.
Yeah, right.
They treat us like lice. Why would, yeah, this is again, perfect
don't
example.
Let them shave, don't let them shave us off the scalp of their existence.
Perfect example of how, what a mishmash this is. What a just complete, like, you know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. They think we're lice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
I guess this is probably a good time to let the listeners know that we won't be releasing the short hour-long version of this podcast. We'll be going back, recording a bunch of new stuff, color matching it, balancing the audio, and releasing the assembly cut of this edition with an extra 37 minutes of audio recording.
We talked a very long time, but there's a lot. I mean, this movie is fucking weird and it's a lot weird. More
it was.
Difficult.
What a great experience. I loved watching it.
There's a giant video camera when the crew gets there at the end. There's somebody shooting with a big old like 1985 style VHS camcorder.
He's like shooting on VHS. Yeah.
We want to document it. That is a sort of an amazing moment. It's really one of the only sort of archival moments in the Alien franchise that I can think of, other than like the ongoing theme of Ripley's logbook or log recordings.
Well, I was going to mention that too. Go ahead.
No. For archiving information, which is a frequent trope in science fiction movies, it's interesting that this is the first time that we have this overt moment of archiving.
It's an epistolary film series, which calls to mind Dracula, which calls to mind the fact that there's a Renfield character in each of the films, namely, you know, Ash, and then Burke, and then the Renfield character is extremely Renfieldian in the serial killer. What's his name? Golic, right? Is very much a Renfield character.
This is especially going to be interesting in Resurrection, where we have a mass of Renfields, where we have like a critical mass of Renfields.
Yeah.
Anyway. I have to say, I enjoyed watching this movie with the idea that we were going to talk about it, because so much is going on in it. And it really is kind of hard to put together, which is partly because it's bad in some ways, but also like that, you know, it's like bagginess makes it quite, I don't know, makes it interesting. It makes it interesting.
There's a lot to say. It's just so weird that they decided to have almost all the actors have these really thick accents.
Well, and just this, all of these like British character actors, and like half of these guys were in With Nail and I.
They wanted Richard E. Grant in the Charles Dance role.
I don't even understand that part.
If I recall right, the studio refused it because he wasn't manly enough.
Richard E. Grant not manly enough.
a mere single Y chromosome. And from Fury.
But then they went for Charles Dance. I mean, I'm not saying he's not manly, but
at least
he's baffling.
He's slimy.
It's weird.
It's weird. It's a weird movie. We got to sign off because you guys have things to do, a life to live, and I don't, but that's fine. I got to edit the episode.
Well, it's like 95 degrees here, so I feel like I'm already melting slowly away.
Super hot here too, so I'm going to go. We're going to figure out how to beat the heat. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with Alien Resurrection, directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet from 97?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And it's just going to get stranger and stranger.
It's
going
to get stranger. Yeah.
Winona Ryder. Who would have guessed she joined the Alien franchise?
Who would have thought? You would not guess it from this movie.
No.
Oh, man. All right. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Yep. We'll be back.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.